Hello, I'm Shweta Hariharan, and you're listening to The Scope at Ryerson. Here today with me is award-winning Canadian author Cynthia Flood, whose new collection of short stories named Red Girl, Rat Boy has had many readers, including me, vexed, perplexed, and thoroughly enjoying ourselves. The staccato rhythm in her writing is the heartbeat of the diverse stories, linking them in surprising ways. One story in this collection has already been included in the 2013 edition of Best Canadian Stories. Thank you so much for joining me, Cynthia.
I'm happy to be here, Shweta.
I'd like to get into the book and its particulars in a little bit, but first, I'd like to know a little bit more about you. You grew up in a family of academics, so your mom was a novelist and your dad a historian. How did this influence you growing up, and did you ever resist the literary pull?
No, I never did. I think I was drawn to it probably from the beginning. I was very lucky. Reading and writing were honored in where I came from. And to have ambitions to be a writer was seen as perfectly normal. And, they're great gifts my parents gave me. They gave me the love of literature, love of reading. They gave me their writing skills, or I inherited those, or some of them made them my own, etc. But yes, no, that was all good.
Excellent. I'm really glad to hear that. You've written a few collections of short stories. So you have The Animals in Their Elements, My Father Took a Cake to France, and English Stories. Can you tell me of the process of how you start writing a well-linked set of short stories? Do you have a thematic connection in mind while you're writing, or is it more that you just start writing what you feel, and then it turns itself into a collection?
Well, in the case of the English stories, that is very much a linked collection, and you'll probably enjoy that when you read it, I think. And that began with one story which I wrote in the mid-90s, and then I wrote another one a few years later. I hadn't planned to, but same characters, same setting, etc. And then when I got the idea for the third, I am slow about some things, it occurred to me, this could be a series. And over the next 4 or 5, 8 years, I guess, I finished writing the English stories. I think there are 12 stories in that book, and they're all set in 1950s England, when the British Empire is just collapsing, but a lot of people there don't understand that yet. Hmm. The other books, Animals in the Elements, and the Dad Cake book, and the present one, The Red Girl, Rat Boy, those are more, I had accumulated enough stories to make a book. I found publishers who were interested, and they were published. And this latest one, The Red Girl, Rat Boy, it really is very diverse. And I'm interested to know that you see some thematic connections or stylistic connections, but really I didn't know how to order it, so I gave it to the publishers and they did it. So they arranged it in the order they thought was suitable.
I definitely did see some connections in there, although it took a couple of times of rereading them to see it and to feel it. And also reading other people's reviews and feelings on your work really got me to think, you know what, that's so true that a lot of these characters are the same in some ways. You're an activist, whether it be for women, anti-war efforts, our environment, and you've written a lot about this topic, especially feminist politics. So how does this relate to your stories? Do you think any anger, sorrow, or pain translates itself into these stories? And is that a part of why they're so powerful?
Well, it may be. It's interesting that you say that. I was very active in the far left and the women's movement, especially in the 1970s and early 80s. And in particularly with reference to the far left, I was a member of a Trotskyist organization for 5 years. I've tried several times, or a number of times, to write about that, and I have never felt that I got what I wanted to. But the two stories in this book, in Red Girl, Rat Boy, that relate to that period, the Dirty Work and Blue Clouds, I do feel I have got something of what I wanted to say about that period. And I'm really happy about that. I was beginning to think it would never happen. But I guess maybe it's long ago enough now that I'm able to do that. I think that the strength of my feelings about the women's movement and anti-war and the environment, that probably does energize some of the stories or some of the characters in some of the stories. But I have never set out to make a political point by writing a short story, because they don't work that way.
That's very interesting for me to hear, that they don't work that way. The way you've written Red Girl, Rat Boy, the stories make the reader have to read between the lines, which is actually pretty rare, especially in young adult literature, as I've grown into short stories. I've noticed, in one of your interviews, you mentioned that a lot of authors give readily a list, a grocery list. You know, and in fact, you are the kind of reader that wants to work for that, maybe imagine that. So that, I found that really interesting. It's interesting that you have this expectation, this requirement for the reader to read into implications, to infer a few things, to have to work to understand the plot and characters. I had to reread a few of these, like I said, to get some clarity. And is this something that you intentionally did?
It's often said that writers write the kind of work that they like reading. And I think that's true for me. I mean, I like a lot of different kinds of books. I mean, I read a lot. I read a lot of junk. I read a lot of really junky mysteries. I read thrillers. I read very unimportant nonfiction. I read widely. But when I am reading something that's important to me, by a writer, for example, William Trevor, if you're becoming interested in short stories, that is a writer I would really direct you to. I mean, what that man can do with short fiction is just unbelievable. But when I'm reading, for example, something by him, I like to be in a state of what I would call alert awareness. I don't want to think about anything else. I want to be fully attentive, and I want to just receive all those little signals that he's sending me. So my ideal reader would be in that circumstance, and my ideal reader would be willing, like you, to give it a sudden crack. I would hope that even a reader who is a bit puzzled would be curious enough or got kind of enough of the good stuff the first time around, say, wait a minute, let's go back and see what did he actually say to her on page 43 or whatever. And I think if the reader did that, that would pay off. So that's the kind of fiction I like reading when I'm reading good fiction, and that's the kind that I guess at my best I like writing. I mean, there's some stories in this book I think that's true of. There's some of them that are more open or more easily accessible, put it that way, but there are some certainly that are a bit tricky.
Yes, you know what? I'm so glad to hear that you said your ideal reader, even if they're perplexed, like they're allowed to be perplexed, because at some points I was like, I feel really sad that I don't get this, you know? And I wish, I'm glad to have you here so you can provide some more clarity, but I've pored over so many reviews not trying to understand some of these things.
But I think if I might say that there's, I mean, short stories are not exactly like poetry for 1,000 different reasons they aren't, but there are similarities that when you're reading poetry, again, I would say probably, and a lot of poets would like you to be in that state of alert awareness and prepared for your mind to make jumps, and sometimes it wouldn't quite make all the jumps, but you might go back a day later and say, ah, you know, and that's fine.
Right, that's absolutely true. And I think your book definitely provides that, so I really recommend it. I read the title story, Red Girl, Rap Boy, at least 3 times. I have to say, it was fascinating. I really felt for Marcia's hollow heart. Marcia's fixation with beautiful red hair juxtaposed with her classmate, Rat Boy's growing obsession on her, with her mother and aunt's shallow, meaningless talk. To me, it honestly felt unnervingly familiar. Can you tell me what your inspiration for this story was and why you chose this as the title story of your collection?
Well, the second question is easier to answer than the first. I chose the title because it is very odd, and I thought it would be noticeable, and it is, and I was so gratified when the designer at Biblioasis, Kate Hargraves, came up with that cover. I just about bit a piece out of the television, out of the computer screen when I saw it. I was so pleased. But as to how the story came about, I don't remember exactly where the... It actually is a story that developed and then had another whole part to itself, because I wrote first just the story of Marcia and her obsession with the red hair. And I'm not really sure how I came to that. I really don't know. I mean, I have grandchildren who were reading fairy stories, and I remember looking through books, etc., and so on. But I wrote a little story about her, and then the moment of discovery was just at her cutting the hair and the, you know, the kind of the fuss that happened after it. And it was awfully short. I think I wrote it originally to send into one of those flash fiction things online, about 500 words or something. But it did seem kind of skimpy. And I thought about that, and a couple of weeks later I thought, you know, there should be somebody else. And there had been this boy who briefly turned up, and I thought, it's him. He's the person who needs to get bigger, needs to be more of him. And there needs to be kind of a matching story, sort of matching or parallel. And because it is, in kind of a way, you know, sort of a fairy story. I mean, he just disappears at the end. We don't know what happened to him. We don't know what happened to the red girl. And we don't exactly know what happened to Marcia, except it probably wasn't very good.
Definitely something that I keep thinking about as to where that hollowness came from, and why it keeps continuing in her life, and why she's unable to. Anyway, it's something that it haunts me for sure. In the stories, it seems that marriage doesn't generally work out for any of the protagonists. In Eggs and Bones, there's contempt almost to the point of rude cruelty between what seems is a fairly new couple, married couple. And in Dirty Work, Catherine is jailed by her marriage, realizing in her 70s that it brought her no happiness. Julie in Addresses has a huge jerk of a husband, controlling, manipulative, and nasty. And it seems that the prescription of happiness, I mean, prescription for happiness, especially for women, isn't working, like marriage as the prescription. So why do you think that is? And do you feel that way as personally, that marriage isn't a prescription for happiness?
I don't think anything is a prescription right. for happiness. But so all of those three stories are quite different. I mean, Julie is a story from the 1960s. And at that point, still, there was this absolute template for young women that this is what you were supposed to do. And she did it. And she believed herself, I think, to be in love with Jeremy. I think probably he even believed that he was in love with her. But I mean, they were just following a script, and a script is not enough to, you know, fully embody, you know, kind of a full relationship. I think, in a way, the people I would feel most hopeful for are Kira and Norman, who are fighting and crabby and
right.
barking and biting, etc.
You're right.
But I think that neither of them understands the pain that the other is going through. I mean, Norman is being a complete asshole, and at some level he knows that. Mm. And Kira is exhausted, and you don't live well when you're exhausted. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't think she should be exhausted because she thinks she should be full of mother love and blah, blah. And I would bet that when they get past all that, which I think probably they will, I mean, they are trying to connect, I think that one may work out okay. Mm. Now, Catherine in Dirty Work, that's a more, that's kind of an old person sad story of mm-hmm. realizing, you know what, it didn't work and it was never going to.
Mm-hmm.
And again, under other circumstances, if Catherine had been better looking, if she had been slightly younger, if she had thrown herself into the women's movement more wholeheartedly,
right.
things might have been different, but none of that happened. And she is, after all, a notary, and her task in life is to witness, and that's what she went ahead and did rather than engaging herself fully in the world that she was involved in.
Wow, right. The life choices for the characters in the book seem to be determined by random events, other people's opinions, and societal expectations. What are you telling us through these tales? If you could give us a lesson, I would love to know, that links all these stories, like a moral lesson, a life lesson, what would it be?
I don't know if I could do that. I guess in the case of Catherine, again, from Dirty Work,
mm-hmm.
This is someone who's still a lot of her activities are motivated by spite, all her her activities in relation to, I've forgotten her name for the moment, but you know,
right.
younger woman.
Yes.
That's motivated by spite, and that's not a good emotion to let your life be motivated by. But in other stories, they're like in the sister-in-law story, Joyce, the mother of Stanley.
Mm.
Now, she is a very bossy, controlling person, but she does truly believe herself to be acting for the good of others. And she can't see that, A, that she isn't acting for the good of the others, and B, that what she's doing is making herself into a really unpleasant person. So she's fixated on this notion of there's one reason only for what I do, and it is my reason, which is a good one. And that's not a viable way to go through the world. I mean, I think that every act, every major act, certainly, that we undertake, yes, it has a particular meaning, which is why we do it, but there's probably kind of a cloud of other things around it, some of which we see and some of which we don't.
Mm.
Like the mum in the beginning story, the to-be queen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a woman who loves her children. There's a woman who tries to do her best for her children. And it was her view that not mentioning or hardly mentioning the child who died was the best way to help the family go forward,
mm-hmm.
which probably means that for her it was the least painful way to go forward.
Right.
But it really wasn't a good idea, you know. It
no.
was not a good idea, and you can see that kind of cascade of difficult events. The two sons, who one has no children,
mm-hmm.
one has a partner with children whom he doesn't allow into his life, really.
Right.
And Coral has a child out of wedlock, and then the other children kind of goes
yeah.
overboard.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm not saying all those people didn't have their own decision-making powers, too, but the mother thought she was doing one thing, and she was doing a lot more things as well.
Right. Those are really great lessons, because I can think of people in my life, especially because I come from a very tight cultural life, where there's lots of expectations, societal expectations. And the culture there dictates that, you know, there's one way to be sort of a, what is the word, a good person. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying about the mom in the first story is absolutely people in my life that I can see. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I think it's amazing that there's some validation there for me that, you know what, this isn't the right way to be. So this is something that I really wanted to ask you. So in terms of being an activist, what advice would you give youth of today who are fighting for gay rights, women's rights? And what approaches are most effective in your experience? What would you tell youth of today to avoid in their efforts? For example, I am an animal rights activist, and I try hard to spread the message, but there's a lot of anger in me, and I find that the anger takes my power away. How do you deal with your very real feelings and the knowledge that some people just won't get it?
Yes, that's true. They will not get it. They will not ever get it. And I think that being an activist is one of the best ways to not to dissolve your anger, because your anger is part of your strength, too, as I'm sure you know, but is better as a way to make it be a constructive force rather than a destructive force. Because the destruction, I'm not referring, you know, going and trashing buildings or whatever. I mean, that is a tactic. It's not one I approve of, mm-hmm. but it is a tactic. But often what happens is the destruction comes back on the person doing it, because that it's better to do something that builds or creates than to do something that destroys, even if it's only plate glass windows. Generally speaking, I mean, there are times, I think, when you have to do the plate glass windows, but I don't think we're there yet. But I think that it's a very difficult time to be an activist, because in a lot of ways the corporations now have such power, and they are so kind of invisible or behind screens. It's very hard to get at the responsible force. But it is 100% a class society. This has not changed. The people with the money are the ones in power, and they are ever more dictating what happens to everybody else on the globe. And so anything that you can do that exposes that fact, that helps people to see that, you know, it is not your fault that you probably that you were homeless, or that you were unemployed, or that you lost your house, or you don't have a job, or all you can do is a barista with a PhD. You know, that's not really your fault. Other factors are at play. Now, the animal thing, that's very difficult, because there are a lot of people who think that's, I know people who think that's kind of unimportant in comparison to human problems, and that's not true.
It is not true at all. Yes.
But it is, I think that's one thing. I would say that the single most harmful force I have seen in my years of what were once very intense activism, now or less so, the worst thing is sectarianism, when you start saying, my struggle is more important than yours, and my wrongs are wronger than yours, and my battle is more important than yours, because they love that on the other side, because you're all divided.
Yeah,
on the far left, the cruelty and the meanness and the treachery of the far left organizations toward each other was stunning. Such a waste, such a total waste of energy and force. So don't be sectarian.
No, you're absolutely right. Not sure if I'll include this part, but I noticed that a lot of like civil rights people who went through civil rights movements, they sort of want to claim the civil rights movement, especially like black people want to claim civil rights movements as being for black people and not for gay rights because of their own religious background, which is so hard to talk about because you don't want to. I don't want to offend anybody. I know what they've been through. It's not like we're asking gay people to drink out of a different water fountain, but it's so much more systematic than that because of these, because what, like in advertisements of what is wrong and right is so controlled by the corporations, and we're so influenced and susceptible to them. And when you look at like the struggles now, they're not comparable to the 60s because it was such a different time. But because of that, I hate that it's being claimed, and that puts a divide, like just like you said, and it completely is a distraction as well, because nobody wants to be competing for who is the most wronged.
Who's the most oppressed. Yeah.
And I mean, everybody's been oppressed. I mean, well, not everybody, but there's been, I guess I'm a woman and I'm a minority, so I mean, I've been lucky enough to be in this country and feel completely free to be who I am, but I know that if I were here 20 years ago, 40 years ago, I have aunts that came here earlier who been through things that I didn't go through, that...
Very different for them. Very right. different for them, I'm sure. Yeah. But that hierarchy thing, you know, I think that's something that's profoundly deep in the culture, that there's always somebody at the top, and among the oppressed, there's also somebody at the top and somebody less and less and less. And right. certainly, you know, yes, you can say there are people who have comparatively suffered less, but that doesn't mean their struggle isn't important.
Right. You know? No, definitely. Struggle. And, okay, when we're talking about animals, what kills me is that we, as humans, like to live in denial a little bit, mm-hmm. More than a little bit. There's been studies where Harvard University put out a study where, you know, super educated students are looking at something depressing, instantly click off, watch cat photos because they just want to avoid that, you know, the fact that it's depressing. And I get that. But that doesn't mean we should stop. We should still do something about it. You know, we can't just be like, oh, well, that's just the way it is. And I feel like lately we've been having more of that. I want to see a revolution happen in terms of mm-hmm. animal rights. A lot of the times when I talk about it, I feel like I'm automatically labeled. I know this is the age-old struggles of anyone trying mm-hmm. to fight something. But, you know, like, it's like, I'm a vegetarian. It's like a dirty word. They're like, oh, you know, I like my meat. I can't give up my bacon or whatever. And it's so
We're not really talking about that, you know.
Yeah.
We're not really talking about that. We're talking about systemized cruelty
yeah.
to feed animals, like cattle particularly, and poultry also.
Pigs.
And pigs, yes. One of my older daughter is a vegetarian, and she tells this very funny story some years ago, 15 years ago, I guess. She was, because it was so difficult, she has children and her husband eats meat, and it was just all the different foods. It was just a real pain. So she was driving, I think, from Hamilton to Toronto, and she had just been thinking about, well, maybe I should go back to eating meat. And just at that moment, a large truck filled with screaming pigs went past her, and she thought, nope, not going back to meat.
No,
definitely not going back to meat. No.
Yesterday, I was crying for so many hours, and it was pretty stupid because I was on my commute, and sometimes I watch videos, and I was watching James Cromwell. He's
mm-hmm.
amazing, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I love the way he speaks.
Yeah.
He's such a wise guy. And he was talking about how these pigs, like Walmart, has all these factories, and how they're mistreating, and there was footage, and I mean, these images were, like, crushing, soul-crushing. And my immediate reaction was to cry and be angry mm-hmm. and, like, for the rest of the evening, glare at everybody because I think everybody's such mm-hmm. jerks, are humans such jerks. And then I thought about you and how you're able to, I mean, people like you have been able to do something in terms of organization and get some stuff done, you know. And I guess for me, I can't be angry anymore. I mean, I can be angry, like you said, it's a power, but I'm not allowed to be resentful or spiteful, which mm-hmm. is what you mentioned before.
Which is harmful.
Yeah, it's really harmful.
Just on that that thing of, you know, watching videos like that, something that can be helpful is if you actually think of yourself as a valuable element in the process of the struggle for social change. And if you know that you react like that to such videos, maybe you should find different places and times in which to, if you feel you must watch them, then maybe you need to do that in a different time and place, not when you're just heading into your day
right.
and not when you're just coming home and you're dead tired,
uh-huh.
because they're going to knock you off balance for 24 hours.
Right.
You know, and just so think of yourself as a valuable process among all the other mm-hmm. processes, and take care of that process and make sure that it does
you're
the best
so right.
work it can, you know.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. I think that once I start getting, now I feel much better. You know, I don't think people are evil anymore. But then that anger, all those mm-hmm. feelings and those, I could have put them into much better use if I had been in a more calmer place.
Yes.
And
yes.
I do see that, for example, James Cromwell and the company he's helping is called Mercy for Animals. He and this company are trying to do something good. They're
mm-hmm.
showing this video
mm-hmm.
because they want you
mm-hmm.
to do something. It's not that they want you to sit there and cry and then forget about it the next day.
No, you're clearly not going to forget about it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, it can be, I mean, I think we all have those moments when it's kind of almost luxurious to cry about something or to feel
yes.
sad. You kind of go down and wallow in it. But the wallowing part doesn't really get very far. So
you're absolutely right. And I'm glad that I'm glad you addressed this because I've been talking to people about what happened in the video. And there are a lot of people that just don't want to watch it. They don't want to discuss it with me and,
yes.
or hear about it.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's okay. You know what? I'm accepting that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure there's things that doesn't make them bad people, but it's hard for me not to think of them as bad people that they're not compassionate
for animals.
You
don't get this, yes.
Yeah, I'm like, how do you not care about these little pigs, you know? Anyway, I really appreciate your time.
Let me say just one more thing about that.
Yeah, yeah.
We're kind of babbling here. You're going to edit this, I can tell.
No, I'm not at all.
But another way to think about it is, what would I want these people to do? Not what do I want them to feel, but what do I want them to do? Do I want them to donate to James Cromwell's organization? Do I want them to sign a petition? Do I want them to write a letter? Do I want them to make a phone call? What do I want them to do? And if you can get them to do that, then, you know, they'll help with what they feel.
Right.
Just get them to do what you want if you can.
Well, I'm definitely monitoring their reactions. I'm like, what are you thinking right now? Don't you feel, why aren't you getting so upset? And I've noticed that people don't really want to talk to me after that, which is why I wanted to ask you this, because I guess being in it for a long term, you kind of learn these lessons. You know, it's not, I turned vegetarian 3 years ago and I was still a teenager, and, you know, I can be pretty emotional about these things, but anyway, there's value in that too.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely.
And I've just learned so much just talking to you for
the
last...
You don't be one of those turned off people who never has any emotional affect. Never, never, never.
I can't even believe those people exist. I wonder what's going on in their minds, you know? And people who can't empathize with innocent creatures that don't have a voice, I don't understand them. I wish I kind of did, because I wish I could understand them so that I would feel less bad about it, because I'm like, you know what? We're the same. You know what? It's fine. It's just normal. But I don't think it's normal. I think it's horrendous. And
that's good.
No, yeah.
It's good that you think that.
Yes, and I'm glad that other people think that way too, because I know there's very, very real people out there who think that way. And James Cromwell is amazing. Anyway, I just wanted to thank you so much for giving me your time and basically enlightening me with a lot of your thoughts, processes on your work. We've been listening to award-winning Canadian author Cynthia Flood. We've been speaking about her fantastic new book of short stories, Red Girl, Rat Boy. Thank you so much once again, Cynthia Flood, and I'm grateful for your time.
Well, thank you.
All right.
I don't know if the book is in the college bookstore. It might be. You can also get it. You can get it on Amazon. So you could say that if you felt like it. You could add that.
Yes, I will add it. That's what I was going to ask you, actually. So Amazon, it is on Amazon. And I'm going to check if it's in the bookstore. I'm going to add check it right now.
And see if it's in the library, too, because it might be in the university library.
Right. Okay, I'll definitely add all that.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Yay. Okay.
I was pleased to find it's in the Toronto Public Library System. They have an e-book, and they have 8 copies, and they have...